O'Clock.
Die Tribüne erhebt sich und die Anne in Linz bebt ein erstes Mal. Linz schlägt zu! Das ist unglaublich, was die Black Wings hier zelebrieren!
Flying High, ein Unibet Hockey O'Clock Spezial. Incredibly enough, this is the penultimate episode of Flying High. It's already episode number 9. And for a change, because of all the forwards that we had on the program, it's nice to have a defenseman again on the podcast. We had Alex Weston, the goalkeeper, a couple of episodes ago. Of course, we had Danny Ehrman on the last one, another forward. Now it's back to playing defense. And who could better talk about playing defense than this guy who's now on the Unibet Hockey O'Clock line? It's, of course, Adrian Wiedemann. And Adrian, so thankful that you're taking the time. Early morning your time, late afternoon Austrian time, and very much looking forward to everything that you have to say about the 11-12 season.
Well, first of all, this is an honor to be on your podcast. And just having listened to my teammates before me, and mostly the English ones, because I've lost my German in the last 8 to 10 years since I've been back over in Colorado, but it's an honor to be here, and I appreciate you having me on.
Now, people can't see your background, but it's heavily branded. And I guess with the recent happenings in the University of Denver winning the NCAA championship and now tying the University of Michigan for most titles in NCAA history, of course, that University of Michigan that they beat in the semis, aka the Frozen Four, in overtime, how big was the smile when it happened, and how big did that smile grow when it was clear that the University of Denver got the championship?
Well, for that's a huge win for the University of Denver, and I think the biggest thing that people don't understand about that game is it was a retribution game. Back in 2002. DU and Michigan played at Yost Arena in the regional final, and Denver was the home team for that game. So they were given Michigan's locker room for that game, and Michigan won that game in overtime. And as soon as that game ended, they were banging on the door trying to get back into their locker room. So there's a lot of built up animosity over the years. And the fact that Michigan won't play Denver during the regular season really gives it that much more competition when these two teams meet. And I've got a number of friends that played at Michigan, and it was just really fun to be able to connect with those people and start some shit talking beforehand and even more after the fact. But I'm just super proud of DU, and not only that win, but the national championship win. And I've got that whole coaching staff there, close friends of mine, and I just love being a part and being an alumni of that institution. So
that is the interesting part, and that's something a lot of Austrians don't understand, because there's no collegiate university sports quote-unquote system happening in Austria or the continent. Now, you're 15 years removed from being the captain of the University of Denver. 15 years is a long time, and eventually we're going to talk about the 10 years, or obviously the title that happened 10 years ago with Linz. But 15 years removed from being a captain of the University of Denver, how strong are the ties still as an alum to the program?
They're stronger than ever. When I came to Denver, I didn't realize it at the time, but it completely changed the trajectory of my life. And, you know, I still live in Denver. My wife is from here. Obviously, I've got two young kids now. And unknown at the time, you just don't really understand how it changes you. An institution like that, the alumni that you get to connect with, and the opportunities that are presented to you after the fact. But, you know, being a captain at Denver was one of the greatest honors that I've ever had. Just knowing the people that have come before me, and the people that I'm representing when while wearing the C on your jersey is, you know, it's phenomenal. It's a phenomenal experience that I couldn't trade for anything.
Now we're recording this conversation in the middle of April. It's gonna air in 12 days' time, and left and right in Europe, champions are now being crowned. A couple of weeks back, we've had the local leagues champion being crowned. Switzerland's championship's going to be awarded. Germany is going to crown the champion. Now, you being 10 years removed from the championship in Linz, how often in those 10 years did you think back of that night, everything that happened on April 1st, 2012?
I mean, it's probably on a weekly basis, you know, where I will sit down and, you know, I'll be needing a mental break and I just, you know, slip into some daydreaming, if you will. But a lot of that is recollections of my time in not only Linz, but Europe and my past career and my past life, I like to say. But that night in Linz was something special, you know, and I've had the privilege of being a part of a number of championship teams, but I have never been a part of a team like that. And when I say that, it was a group of guys that was we were so close. We had so much fun at the rink, away from the rink. We were just a complete unit, if you would. There was so much camaraderie on that team, so many characters on that team. You know, I like to explain it to people. We were a bunch of characters with character. And having played against a lot of those guys in the past that on that Linz team that I joined, and then getting the opportunity to become teammates with them was special. And I went on to be teammates with those guys in the years to follow as well. So, you know, those are memories that nobody can take from me. Those are memories that nobody can take from my teammates and that special season that we had.
Now, most of the previous episodes were kind of recorded chronologically. I tackled the most important topics chronologically. This time around, and as we're entering the home stretch, I wanted to mix things up a little bit. I've got a couple of key topics that I want to tackle with you. And that's also because I received a, I'd say, loaded statement. It's coming from your former captain, Phil Lucas. I asked him to talk a little bit about you, his experiences with you, everything that went on in 11-12. I suggest we listen in to this together, and then we're going to talk about it.
Adrian Wiedemann, aka Vito. I knew nothing about Vito before he came to Linz, but I soon realized already in training camp that he was the perfect partner to play alongside with Curtis Murphy. Was a pain in the ass to practice against, was never out of position, always had a stick that was always there to interrupt your plays and stuff like that. So, and could also play, like, obviously very productive alongside Curtis. And therefore that was our number one D pair. And soon I realized that we're pretty good there. We're pretty good. So, that's the first thing. And I remember also that we were after game five and we won the championship, that it was then that Vito told me that he was going to leave us to go to Vienna. He already signed. And I remember my jaw just dropped and I said, like, I can't believe this. How did that even happen? And right there, I knew it wasn't going to be the same again, because that was the perfect pair for me. Curtis and him. So that was a big loss. And we never really found somebody to replace him perfectly. That's how good of a player I thought Vito was. That's The other thing I remembered, he was probably, besides me and Bob, he was the most the grumpiest guy in the room. He couldn't match quite Bob, but he was up there. But I think it had something to do with the urge of him being competitive in each practice and games. He just wanted to win the whole time and wanted to do good. So I really appreciated that about him. And last but not least, I think what I remember most about Vito was the constant chirp festival between him and Irms every day in the locker room. And it was quite hilarious. They gave it to each other every day and in a friendly and in a competitive way. And it was always something to enjoy.
It made you crack twice, so that was really nice, especially the back end of it. But I want to start with the first kind of section of the statement, the first things that Phil mentioned when his jaw dropped once he found out that you had signed with Vienna. From your perspective, did his jaw drop indeed? How did you experience that situation once you told him what's going to happen after the season?
Well, I mean, first of all, I was pissed. There was nothing I wanted more than to be back in Linz. You know, I completely agree with his statement. I've never played with a player like Curtis Murphy in my life. And I'll talk more about Curtis later, but I was not thrilled that was happening. My experience in Linz was again nothing. I was a part of a team that I had never been a part of before, with the amount of characters that were in that room and the amount of fun that we had on a daily basis. It was a situation every day where I enjoyed going to the rink. You know, was I grumpy? Like you said, of course. I was single at the time. I was lonely. You know, and getting up every day and going to the rink sometimes was a battle. But once that door opened to the rink and I got to sit down next to Irms and he would poke a little fun, he would poke the bear, if you will. It was game on from a competitive standpoint. In the room and as well on the ice. So, you know, as far as that decision to go to Vienna, that was a decision that I did not take lightly. It was more about Linz than it was about Vienna, because after Vienna had come to me and offered me a contract, I attempted to get Linz to get even relatively close to where they were at, and they couldn't do it. So I don't want to blame anybody in that situation other than myself. It's unfortunate. That's the business of what's going on. But at that time, I knew that Phil was disappointed when I told him that. And, you know, because Phil's heart has been in Linz, it's always in Linz. I'm super excited for his new opportunity there. I think that's fantastic. And, you know, it's one of those things that's kind of out of your control at that point when other people are making decisions. So.
And then again, what fans and organizations and players and agents and managers each and every offseason have to sometimes learn the hard way. At the very end, it's a business, and there are business decisions that have to be made. Was that the toughest business decision of your entire career?
Yes, I would say it was. And the reason being was when I first turned professional, I was looking for every opportunity that I could get and trying to fight and scrape and stay in lineups and get some games in at the American League level and at the East Coast level. And, you know, everybody's dreams of playing the NHL, but, you know, that didn't happen for me. And when I was playing in the American Hockey League, it came to a point where I wasn't playing. You know, I was sitting in the stands. There was a lot of NHL draft picks that weren't necessarily better players than me. but they were playing ahead of me because of their status, if you will. So I made the decision that it was time to go over to Europe. And, you know, getting that year and a half in the DEL was a fantastic experience. Getting accustomed to the European style of play was awesome. It suited my game perfectly. And, you know, again, once my time in the DEL came to an end, I was kind of at a point in my career where it seemed like every summer, every off season, I was fighting for a place to play. And my agent came to me that off season after I was playing in Germany, and he said, "What about Linz?" You know, I didn't know anything about Linz. You know, I'll be honest, I kind of viewed it as a demotion. You know, when you think of the German league versus the Austria league at that time, it was kind of I'm kind of taking a step back. But the second I walked in that door in Linz, and from the first practice, I was, holy shit, you know, this is fantastic hockey. This is on par with where I was in Germany. This team we have is better than the majority of those German teams that I played against and was a part of. So, you know, from that standpoint, I knew early on that I made the right decision to go to Linz. It was kind of a leap of faith, but I knew really early on in that year that I wanted to stay there for years to come. And, you know, it's unfortunate that wasn't viewed mutually from both sides. So.
When you got to Linz and experienced that kind of hockey that you've had to, as you mentioned it, get accustomed to or get used to the European style of hockey, how does it work for a defenseman? And I've asked many, many people and I've got many different answers, so I'm really curious how you view it. How does it work for a defenseman who's used to be playing on the small sheet of ice to go to Europe and suddenly having the bigger sheet of ice? How does it change your angles, your way of playing, your skating?
Well, the game seems faster on the bigger ice sheet. And it's not because the players are faster. It's because the puck moves faster because it travels further distances. As a defenseman, when you look at the sheet of the ice, all of the face-off dots are the exact same on an Olympic sheet as it is on a 200 by 85 or NHL sheet. So as a defenseman, you really need to concentrate on your lines, on your dot lines, we call them. So it's a wider rink. So you need to be able to adjust your skating to keep people to the outside of the rink and maintain those dot lines, if you will, to control your angles and your skating. Now, the one big adjustment that I had was on the penalty kill. When you're penalty killing, I always had the tendency of, and was taught on the smaller sheet, that to be an effective penalty killer, you got to pressure all the time. You really have to pressure, because the rink is so much smaller. You can close gaps on players much quicker. But that's a recipe for disaster on the Olympic sheet. You really need to think the game at a much higher level. You need to be able to read your opponents, read their structure, read what they're trying to accomplish and take away. Their second pass, not just their first pass. So from a defensive standpoint, it was more about containing and teaching myself how to, you know, I've always had a good stick, like Phil mentioned. That's been one of my skills and one of my skills that I, you know, take a lot of pride in. So that was a huge plus for me, but it was just more about putting the thinking behind it and trying to be one step ahead of the opponent on the bigger sheet.
Was there a point in Europe, was it maybe that first half a year with Iserlohn the first full season with Iserlohn, or maybe even in Linz or later, where you thought, okay, now you've got the full grasp of doing everything that you want to do on a big sheet of ice?
Well, that came early in Linz. And that came from playing with Curtis Murphy. Just his experience in Europe and his career in Europe, his ability to, you know, let's face it, he made me look better than I really was. You know, he and I would get on the ice and he would tell me what to do. And I would say, no, Curtis, I'm just going to give you the puck. You're getting the puck. Every time I would get the puck, I was going DDD to Curtis because he would make something happen. I was more of a facilitator for him too. You know, I've never experienced a player like that who, you look at the different eras of the NHL and kind of the players that are involved in the NHL at certain points in time. And I have never seen a player, you know, he was a 9-time American League All-Star when I played with him. Had he been younger and played in this era, he'd be a 9-time NHL All-Star at this point in time. The way he thought the game, the way that he moved the puck, the way that he treated his teammates, the way that he led by example, I've never experienced anything like that. And I mean, shit, we were plus 42 that year. And that's insanity. I mean, you don't get many opportunities to play with players like that. And it makes it, it's a little disheartening to see a player like that not get an opportunity in the National Hockey League. But I've never been more fortunate as a player to get to play with somebody on the same ice, let alone be a defensive partner of his. So,
and that's some of the greatest credit someone has ever given to someone else, at the very least here on this podcast. How does this work in training camp? Because I've heard it now multiple times on Flying High as well, that Curtis Murphy caught a lot of people's attention. Were you like the guy who said, Coach, I think I want to be on a pair with him. Was there an open competition where just slotted in next to each other?
Yeah, every day before practice, we had 30 minutes. All the D-men went out there. Curtis sat in the stands with a clipboard and picked his D-pair, you know. And all those decisions were made by Rob Dom and Soupsy. You know, that I didn't, you know, it was fun to listen to Rob's podcast to really see what went on behind the scenes a little bit as far as how he joined the team and how they tried to pick the personnel. You know, Curtis also, he played with Bobby Lucas quite a bit when we were going through some struggles and swapped that up. But, you know, it was really interesting to hear Rob's take on it. It was also interesting to hear everybody else's take on it, because I'll reiterate the sentiment that Rob was the smartest man in the room. He just didn't really act like it, that's a compliment to him. You know, he ran a tight ship when it came to personnel. He knew exactly what he wanted and what he wanted out of his players, you know, and he got it. And, you know, to much of people's chagrin sometimes, you know, they're on every team, there's always chatter. I should be playing with this guy. I always should be playing with that guy and that guy. And when you don't get your way, you kind of, you're pissed off a little bit about it. But I think Rob pushed a lot of the right buttons at the right times, as far as his personnel decisions. And, you know, I had no control over who my deep partner was. I left that up to the coaching staff, and they guided us in the right direction with all that stuff.
The thing is, we as media members, commentators, experts, etc., we're always talking too much about chemistry, when a line is clicking, when a team is clicking. But very rarely does one talk about defensemen and when they're clicking as a pair. How long did it take you with Curtis to really develop a feel for his game, for him to develop a feel for your game? And did that go faster than with other defensemen?
Oh, of course. I mean, his mental ability to process the game was incredible. You know, I always viewed myself as a very smart player on the ice. So when you put two people like that together, it doesn't take long to form chemistry. You know, I'm talking a couple of games. And the greatest thing about that is when you've got players that think the game well, they're able to communicate that to each other and really make adjustments on the fly, adjust to what the coach is trying to implement in the game, having open lines of communication with the coach, where maybe the coach wants us to do some sort of play on the ice, but you know, we know it might not work that well against what we're seeing from the opponent. So being able to talk to Rob and his coaching staff and make those adjustments on the fly and take the input from its players is also a huge bonus, you know, for any team, you know, and that's something that a lot of teams that don't have success are missing. You know, the coach is he's a dictator out there. He doesn't want to hear from his players. It's his way or the highway type of mentality. And that's the complete opposite of what we had in Linz. We had a true team, and the coaching staff was a part of the players and the players were a part of the coaching staff as well. So
now that you mentioned the absurd plus minus statistics, and I don't think that back in the day the league had an all-star team, but I vividly remember the sheer excellence that you two brought most of the times when you played together to the ice. I remember that season featuring a lot of good defensemen. For example, Jamie Fraser had his very first year with the now Ice League, back in the day, Able League. Matthias Trattnik with Salzburg in his prime. Vienna still having the Lacos brothers in their prime. So in terms of blue line defensemen, an embarrassment of riches, and still you being so much ahead of everybody else, did you at one point realize we're the best D pair in the league?
Probably. I don't recall ever, you know, celebrating something like that. You know, the thing that I vividly remember is knowing that Curtis was the best defenseman in the league. And he would be the best defenseman in a lot of leagues, you know, not just Austria at that time. There were a lot of great defensemen in that league when I was in it. I never viewed myself as one of the top defensemen in that league. That's just the way that I thought. I was always trying to prove, I always felt like I was trying to prove something to somebody, and that somebody always had a knock on me, whether it had been my size or whether it had been my skating, or, you know, everybody thought I had a muffin of a shot at some point, but I never thought that I was one of the top defensemen in that league. There was a lot of fantastic players that played on fantastic teams, so.
But still, how does Phil Lucas come to the conclusion that you were the perfect partner for Curtis Murphy? I mean, a D2D pass could have been played by anyone, but he specifically said the perfect partner for Curtis Murphy. Why?
Well, now you're fishing. Now you're fishing. But I think it's because I had the ability to get Curtis the puck when I knew he needed it. And whether it had been on the power play or even strength or shorthanded or whatever the situation was, you know, I was willing to play his Robin while he was Batman. And I had that ability to take a co-pilot seat and let him, you know, not do the fancy things, but give him the ability to do what he was best at, because what he was best at was playing the offensive side of the puck. So if I took care of a lot of the defensive load and got him the puck in good situations, he could do what he did best. Now, I was able to contribute a little bit offensively, but not to the skill set that Curtis had.
One last thing that we have to talk about regarding Phil's statement. He labeled you as the grumpiest guy in the locker room. Now, we already talked about your relationship status or non-existent status at that point in time. But let's settle this once and for all and get your perspective on it as well. Who indeed was the grumpiest guy? Was it Phil? Was it Bob? Or was it you?
Well, Bob didn't say much. You know, I'll take credit that I shouldn't use credit, but I'll accept the fact that I was grumpy for most mornings. Now, when I arrived to the rink, I needed, 10 or 15 minutes until Ehrman fired the first shot in the room, and then it was game on and I woke up. I spent a lot of my nights up late because I had a girlfriend back in the U.S. So we'd spend a lot of time on Skype and stuff like that till, wee hours in the morning. So being grumpy in the morning, that was just a thing for me. It was one of those things where you come in the locker room and you just have to wait for Ehrman to poke me or wake me up, or put a quarter in the jukebox type of scenario and get me wound up. I'll accept the fact that I was grumpy, but you can always count on Phil to be grumpy. You could also count on Bob to be quiet and not say a word, but you could really get Bob going by firing a shot at him, or doing something in practice just to mess with him because he was so competitive. But guys would, in the rare occasion that Bob would get beat in a one-on-one situation or something on the ice, I had never seen somebody get so pissed off in practice, swinging sticks, swearing, you name it, throwing sticks. But that just speaks to the brothers, right? That's the way they grew up. That's the only way they knew they had to compete every single day for their jobs. So,
a lot of people before and you yourself, everybody's talked about the great atmosphere in the locker room and how tight-knit this group indeed was. At what point did you not only think that this group was close in the locker room, but that this group was something special on the ice as well?
Well, I've been fortunate to be a part of a number of championship teams and from experience, every one of those teams had the exact same thing in common. And that is what we had in Linz with that locker room. Now, I will say that the locker room we had in Linz was the best locker room I had been a part of in my entire career. If there was a point in the season where we knew something was special, it probably would have been right before we kind of went on our little skid before the playoffs. Maybe we thought we were king shit of Turd Island, maybe a little bit. But understanding who we had in that locker room, it wasn't a panic scenario whatsoever. There was nobody pushing the panic button. It was just more about maybe a lull and a mental tiredness, if you will, at that point in the season. You've gone through 30 plus games, 40 games. You see the same people in the room every day. Maybe there was a little bit of a disconnect as far as guys weren't having as much fun when you do the same thing for so long, and practices are so competitive, it kind of takes a toll on your mental ability to process. And also, you might lose a little bit of drive, if you will. But you know, that would have been the point, the low point of it. If that's the low point of your season, I mean, what can you complain about, you know?
Right. I want to just wanted to say you're probably in very good shape, but talking about that low point and maybe lacking a little bit of focus, what helped you get back on track and go on that magical ride throughout the playoffs?
Well, I think when you get a bunch of experienced players, guys that have been there before, we had a group of guys that hated losing more than they liked winning. So that's a very powerful thing. And when you start playing in games that, you know, the playoffs start and you start playing in those games that could knock you out, that's where that experience comes in. That's where that knowledge of the game and the calmness it brings over you in those pressure situations when you've got 10 plus guys in the room like that, that's profound. There was never an oh shit moment on the bench. It was very calm. We've got this. Rob Dom led the way with that. Now, did he get fiery? Of course he did. He's a coach. But from a player perspective, we had the horses to get through those mental battles and the ups and downs and the roller coasters of those games, especially, you know, that game 7 against Vienna and those do or die moments. So,
as is the case with each and every episode of Flying High, there's also a trivia question in this podcast, and we're about to tackle the trivia question on this episode. There are two things to win. Obviously, the highly coveted season documentary, season DVD on the Black Wings 11-12. That's one of the prizes that we're going to give away. And of course, provided by our friends over at Unibet, a game-worn Linz jersey with Brian Lebler's name on it from this season. To the person or the people who answer most of the questions correctly, if not all. And this time around, I thought, I do something with the number you wore. You played with number 24 in Linz, and most often there's a story behind a number. Is there a story behind yours, or was it just a random choice?
Well, I grew up, I was always number 7. So I always liked to have number 7. So that was not an option for me a lot of the times, because it's, you know, a pretty easy number to get and a popular number for returning players. You know, when I went to Germany, 7 was already taken. So I settled on 25. And for the reason other than adding 2 + 5 = 7. Now, when I got to Linz, neither 25 or 7 were available. So, you know, 24 was available. It's close, but I mean, you can't have 133. You know, you can't have a 3-digit number. So that would be the only story behind it. I was never really a superstitious player. I just kind of liked my number.
Of course, the good people over at Unibet know that you wore number 24. They, of course, know the question to this, or the answer to this question. Trivia question in episode 9 of Flying High is, how many points, and yes, we're looking for the correct number of goals and assists, did you have after game number 24 in 11-12? You don't have to answer it. Listeners of this podcast have to answer it. Please send the correct answers to unibethockeyo'clock@gmail.com and only unibethockeyo'clock@gmail.com. And speaking of Unibet, they, of course, still have a special offer for all new customers. It's a 400% welcome bonus. Just use the promo code HOCKEY-BONUS while putting in 10 euros into your new account for the first time and receive 40 euros for free. That's right, for free. More details in the show notes of this podcast, as usual. Unibet, by players, for players. And speaking of a player, not only on the ice, but quite literally or verbally speaking in the locker room, of course, Danny Erman sent me something about you.
Of course he did. Yeah.
I suggest we're listening together and then we'll talk a little bit about what Danny said.
Yeah, when I think about Adrian Veidemann, first thing that comes to mind for Vito is he's a winner. You look at the team that Rob put together. Veidemann was a huge piece of that. Winners win. Everywhere he's been, he wins, and it doesn't just happen. Guys that have won at every level, they know what it takes at the beginning of the year. They know what it takes in the locker room. They know what it takes in practice. They know what it takes at off the ice to get the team together. And he's done that. And he's a, you know, fierce competitor. He came from the German league, and I think in his mind it might have been a step down, and he had a chip on his shoulder. And Vito with a chip on his shoulder is a scary guy to play against. But you know, more importantly, he's a great person. We had a lot of fun that year in the locker room. We sat next to each other, and man, can we get the locker room going? He would say something, I'd feed off it, and I would get somebody riled up, and they would start arguing with me. Then Vito would be on my side, and oh, we just have the whole locker room up in arms. Eventually, people knew not to come argue with us. But you know, Vito, still a great friend to this day. And one thing that he had going over in Linz that they probably haven't had since. In his house, we called it the ESPN zone. Every Sunday, he would somehow get all the football games on his TV, and it turned into the ESPN zone, and half or our entire team would be there every Sunday after games. And there's a lot of funny stories that I'll let Vito get into about talking about the ESPN zone. But great teammate, hard worker, passionate, love the guy. Couldn't say enough good things about him.
Now, this is really nice and told a lot about good things about you. I guess it could have been worse with a couple of stories that happened. But please explain the ESPN zone. How did that one develop?
Well, at the time, you know, I was a massive American football fan. And the games obviously played on Sunday in North America. They didn't start until late in the evening. So it was my thing that after that Sunday night game, I would go home and you know, set up my living room with a couple of TVs and just watch football. My girlfriend at the time, my now wife, she was a cheerleader for the Denver Broncos, so that was always my team, and just loving to watch those games. But the most important part of that was having my teammates join me for those games. And those are memories that I'll never forget. Now, I will forget the mess that those guys would leave every Sunday night in my apartment. But, you know, Keller lived right above me, and he would just come down. He never wanted to host because of the mess that was left. And I'm like, buddy, you got to come help me clean this up, you know? But it was just time. Those were some times for us as teammates to appreciate each other, to appreciate the work that we're putting in, have a few beers. In some people's cases, they only drank wine, but really bond as a team. And I'm pretty sure the only people that didn't make it over the ESPN zone were Bob Lucas. Actually, he might've been the only one that never, we'll say everybody attended at some point that year, to some extent, and always tried to have, you know, some food and stuff for the guys, but it was more about being together and again, carrying that locker room off the ice as well. So those were some special times that we had at the ESPN zone. And I will say that it was very rare that anybody's significant other came. So a lot of the time it was guy time, it was teammate time. There were a few instances that wives and girlfriends did come, but probably never returned after their one appearance. So,
and speaking of converting someone to an NFL fan, I myself, I'm a huge NFL fan and follower. Have been for years, and I'm still trying to get Phil Lucas hooked on it. So I guess you tried as well, but eventually this will happen. Just has to happen.
Some things never change.
Behold, we're about to find out in a couple years' time. The second thing I want to talk to you about regarding Danny's statement was how he told the story of you two getting everybody riled up. Was there ever like a tipping point? Because he also said or alluded to guys not wanting to talk to you again. Was there ever kind of tipping point or an argument where you thought, okay, maybe we've taken this too far?
I don't think so. I don't think things were taken too far. Danny and I had a pretty good grasp on how far you could go with certain guys in the locker room. You know, there were guys that you could press a little bit more, and you knew that they didn't take things as seriously as others. I constantly remember Danny and I going after Westy, and it was more of a, it didn't matter what the argument was about, but it was more about Danny and I being on the same page and kind of teaming up on Westy, because Westy's he's an Ivy League grad. He's, you know, he's a smart guy. He's a passionate guy about his opinions on things. So it didn't take long for Ermin and I to figure out that, you know, if one of us fired a shot or at Westy, the other guy was automatically on, I'm on Ermin's team or Ermin's on my team. It doesn't matter whether he agrees with me or not. We had a unique ability to connect with guys that way, and really bring a life to the locker room at times where it wasn't necessarily needed. You know, there were times in between periods where Danny and I would look at each other, and it felt like a morgue in there, and guys weren't alive. So I'd tell Danny to make fun of me, or I'd make fun of Danny, and just to get guys awake, you know, to liven the mood, to get the boys going in the right direction.
One goal I remember so vividly that you scored, where I thought this is kind of the door opener. It feels like the door opener to the championship, happened in game 4 in Klagenfurt. You scoring, as it turned out, the game winning goal on that day, that 4-1 in Klagenfurt, which turned out to be a convincing win, which turned out to be the game that got you to the first elimination game that you took care of. Was that the biggest goal that you scored this season?
Or that season? For sure. For sure. And it's probably one of the biggest goals I scored in my career, or one of the best moments of my career from a personal standpoint. When I think back on my career, there's, you know, probably a dozen or 15 moments that I constantly think about. And that is one of those moments. You know, Danny Obikofer gave me the puck, and as soon as he gave me the puck, we were kind of on a 2-on-1. And from the second he gave me the puck, I remember thinking to myself, I'm not giving it back to him. Like, this is going in the back of the net. Beating Kyoto over the short side shoulder. And I remember kind of celebrating along the boards in that old rink and amongst their diehard fans. It was an awesome feeling. But you know, it had nothing to do with me at the moment. It had everything to do with my teammates and putting us into a position to, you know, seal the deal on that championship. So nothing against Danny. He's an excellent finisher, but I just had that feeling in that moment that this is mine, you know.
And of course, East Gordon that game as well. He had the 1-0 lead. You had the 2-1 lead again. And as it just turned out, it's awfully hard to win a championship on home ice. If we look back on the past decade of hockey in Austria, only two teams had the distinct honor of celebrating a championship on their home ice. Even this year, Salzburg won the championship in four on opponent's ice. How was that after you had the game winner in game four? How was that bus ride back? How much of a will was there amongst the team to close this out at home?
I can't speak for other guys. I just know my personal thoughts on that. And that was that we did it was our regular routine on the bus. It was, we're playing cards at the back, and a couple of guys snuck beers on the bus, even though Rob hated it. You know, it was, we did that all year. That was just part of who we were. You know, we were characters with character, and we weren't going to change at that point. You know, if he didn't say anything by the first week in the season, we were going to get away with it the rest of the year.
You think he knew?
Of course he knew. You know, he knew. Again, Rob was the smartest guy in the room without letting everybody know he's the smartest guy in the room. So he knew his players. He knew what kind of characters we were. He knew what we needed, how we needed to vent, how we needed to get away from the game. And that was one of them, you know. So that bus ride back was very much business as usual, as far as me taking all the money at the card table. And guy, I think Phil Lucas and Frank McDonald, and there's somebody else that still owes me money from that year, but I'll collect at some point. But you know, it's, you get on the bus, you're elated that you won, but there's also a sense of relief, and there's a sense that, hey, I need to wind down and get ready. I'll never forget the drive to that game that we won. Curtis Murphy dad used to pick me up, and pick me and Keller up. And I'll never forget him picking me up. And, there was just a sense when we got into the car that, this was kind of it, for us. There was there wasn't a sense of calm, but it was a sense of, excitement. It was a sense of, urgency. And from the second you got into the rink, it wasn't just the myself, Justin Keller and Murphy that had that same sentiment. It carried throughout that locker room. And it was awesome. You know, it's just an incredible feeling to have even before that game even started.
And as it turned out, 60 minutes later, you were crowned champion. And each and everybody who attended the game at or on that day knew, each and everybody who watched the game knew that you were the best team. You were finally getting the confirmation that you were the best team that year. And as we talked about at the beginning, you knowing, or you standing within the hundreds and hundreds of fans who flooded the ice, you getting your hands on the trophy, confetti lying around everywhere, and you knowing that you were going to Vienna the next year, how bittersweet was that experience for you?
To be honest, I wasn't thinking about the next year. That was very much an in the moment experience for me. That was, if you're able to go back in your life and replay moments, that would be one of them, or hours for that matter. Just not necessarily seeing my excitement, or there's a sense of relief that comes over somebody when they win a championship, and that relief is from the amount of mental effort and physical exertion that are put into things throughout a season. So there's a tremendous amount of relief. It just feels like a giant ape jumps off your back, and now you're just able to be free and live in the moment and celebrate your teammates, celebrate their experiences as well, and watch them be elated in that moment. And seeing you know, the young kids of the families that were there and getting to experience that championship with their father. You know, that's one of my biggest regrets, is not having a family over there with me at that time and getting my children to experience those instances with me. But, you know, getting to see others experience that, that's where my joy came from. You know, again, having been there previously in other leagues and divisions and circumstances, that first professional championship was special to me, as it was to everybody else in that room and the coaching staff and the management, and, you know, probably the biggest and most passionate fan base that I had been a part of in Europe, which, you know, speaks volumes to how much they love the Black Wings, and how much they care for each and every player that's on the ice.
Now, 2 weeks ago, Alex Westlund told us his very unique experience right after having won the championship. And I know there's a lot of stuff that's not rated for a general audience. But if you look back on those nights of and days of celebrating the title, is there something that comes to mind first, a memory that you'll forever cherish?
Well, I think it's that the night of the win. All those other parties and celebrations after the fact are kind of a blur. You know, I remember after we won, and, you know, it was probably a couple hours before the ice even cleared, and we've got fans in the locker room, and you know, I just remember I didn't even shower. I basically just took my shit off and walked over to the bar, and that bar that night, you couldn't even get in the door. I mean, it was, and again, it's not about me, it's not about my teammates, it's about the fans there. And that's the thing I loved about European hockey, was the fan bases drove the teams, and they were the ones who were paying their hard-earned money to come watch us play. And in a smaller community like Linz, they came out in droves every night. I mean, there were times where I would turn to Danny and just be like, how is this rink not 5,000 seats bigger by now? Because it just seems like every game it was packed to the gills, and there were people fighting for sight lines onto the ice. And, you know, it was just something that it's hard to explain, but all the credit needs to go to the people of Linz, and that's because they love the product, they love the players, and they just love their team, and they love the history of the team. So, you know, I would be, if I was a fan of Linz or lived in Linz, I would be especially honored and proud of what they have there and the tradition that they have there, much like I'm proud of being a very small snippet and part of the history there.
I vividly remember the fact that all the games were officially sold out with 3,650 people. I've never seen 3,650 people look so big as a crowd. So there's that about those games.
Just
to round out this conversation, I'm so thankful that you've already taken an hour to be talking about the Black Wings and reminisce about everything that, or a lot of things that went on. Now 10 years removed from it, and if I'm asking you the question in another 10 years or maybe in 20 years, what's going to remain in 20 years' time, 30 years' time from those Black Wings of 2011, 2012?
Well, I think the thing that's going to remain is the relationships. You know, I'm still very much in contact with a lot of my teammates, and you know, more specifically than the North American or the import guys that are still kind of in my geolocation. You know, the other thing that's going to remain are these experiences that we have talked about, because again, they're experiences and moments in time that are ingrained in my mind. that I think about regularly. They're not instances that I'm like, oh, I remember something else, or I remember that. These are plays on the ice that I remember. They're conversations that I had that are, you know, ingrained in my head. Like I explained to you, there's probably 12 or 15 moments throughout my hockey career that I vividly remember, and I can go back to those times and just sit there and smile, you know, and then a good majority of those times were in wins.
Perfect way to round this out. Adrian Wiedemann, thank you so much for doing this, and looking forward to eventually get everybody back together, maybe with the 20-year anniversary.
Yeah, I'll be in on that for sure. You just have to let me know the time and date. Get Pertoller on board.
We will do that. Thank you so much for doing this. All the best to you.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate you.
Exzellente Unterhaltung mit dem schönsten Sport der Welt.
Unibet Hockey O'Clock.